Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from Altaspeed Technologies, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open this hour. To be a part of the program, it is a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. It's 1-855-450-6624, or send an email to live at asknoahshow.com. My name is Noah Chalaya. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah show kicks off this evening. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Ovens. Welcome in, sir.
Good evening, Noah. So have you ever had one of those just inconvenient times where something dies on you?
Happens to me all the time. Very frustrating.
So this week, after getting good spousal approval for the camera system that we've been using around the house, I get the it's not working complaint. And like, oh, well, you know, it's probably just something simple. Show me what you did. So she logs into the Axis camera. The web UI is still functioning. Like, she gets in after a couple seconds wait. Like, well, that's a little strange. It took a little longer than I expected. And then she goes to rotate the camera because it's a pan, tilt, zoom. And in the middle of rotating, the screen freezes. Like, the actual camera pan freezes.
Okay.
So we tried. I was like, oh, well, that's kind of weird. Maybe it's just your browser. I go over to my computer and I can't log in. It's not even responding on the web page. Well, okay. So I'll just turn the PoE port off and back on again.
Yeah, reboot it.
Right? Essentially. And we wait and we wait and nothing happens. So I go out to the camera. I get up on the ladder. I pull the cable out of it. I plug the cable back in. And normally what happens is the camera will reorientate itself. So it will do its validation check, kind of does a 360 spin, kind of moves up and down before returning to its home position. And nothing. Like, there was nothing.
No.
5 minutes goes by. So, like, okay, what could be the problem? I go and get, I have a spare PoE injector specifically for testing, right? Like, I know this thing works. It's heavy duty. Like, it is a brick. Like, it's from the old era stuff. It's 24 volts. It's pretty heavy duty. So I go plug it in and nothing happens. So then I go get another cable and I pull the camera down from its mount and nothing happens. It's dead. And
no, really?
Yeah. Unfortunately. And that's the downside of buying it off of like eBay or whatever, right? Is that while they support their hardware, it was already hard old to begin with. And so it's well beyond its...
So it's a used camera. That's something to be of note. Okay, so let me ask you this. So not just that. So I would understand if the PTZ thing died, like the moving thing was gonna die from the moment it left the factory. But you're telling me even the image sensor, like you can't even get a picture off of the camera anymore.
It doesn't respond to its web page. It doesn't, as far as I can tell, it stopped getting an IP off of the network. Like, it can't find it in the DHCP leases. It just died.
Like, bummer.
Flat out died.
Let me ask you this, Steve. Have you tried factory resetting it?
How would I do that if it's dead?
So I believe what you can do is there's a button on every Axis camera and you hold that button down and then you plug PoE power in and then it'll factory reset. Of course, here's the thing. I wouldn't say there's a bright future in that if it's not responding to the IP address we know it has, if it's not responding to the web UI that you know it has. So I'm not saying that there's high hopes for it, but it might be something you try before you throw it in the trash.
I mean, I could give it a shot. I think that it's unlikely to work from the standpoint of like the heavy duty PoE ejector that I have. It only lights up if there's something it detects on the other end. So one light is I have power. The other light is there's something on the other end. And the second light never lights up when I plug it back into this Axis camera. And so it's possible the Ethernet port got jacked or something, but while this camera is outside, it is protected. Like, it's in a shed outside. So it gets the cold, like it gets the extreme temperatures, like the humidity and stuff like that, but it's not directly exposed to the weather. And it's also one of those inside of the Vandal domes. So even the camera itself is well protected. Honestly, it feels like you could bludgeon somebody. It's you could play Clue with this. Like, I got the butler in the shed with the Axis camera.
Well, that's really disappointing. That's one. That's the first one. I haven't had that experience before, but that's one. So what did you replace it with?
We ended up getting another Reolink camera because honestly, the quality on these things is amazing. I've been really surprised. Part of it is you've got a 10-year-old Axis camera versus a brand new or 10 years or more versus a brand new camera. And so like the night vision is phenomenal. The tracking is so-so, but I don't really care about the auto tracking as much because I treat it as each one of the pan, tilt, zoom, the PTZ, you have an ability to give it a home position, which I'm sure you know, right? And so that means that you can send it all over the place, and after a certain amount of time, it will time out and then return to the position. So I don't really care if it tracks so much, because if we've turned it to look at something, it'll eventually turn back to where we have the preset set. But been really happy with the Reolink. The standard disclaimer here is you have to be aware of what you're buying, because there are some Reolinks that don't support the RTSP or the ONVIF or those sorts of things. So you really have to, like, you have to look. But a general rule of thumb is if it's a PoE device, it will support it. Like, that has been, I have two different variations. I've got the E1 outdoor, and I've got one that's called the TrackMix, which has two lenses on it. And both of those are PoE, and both of those support RTSP, ONVIF, you know, the whole shebang. And they jump right up in Home Assistant, and everything is, you know, happy. I've been very happy with them.
Yeah. Very interesting. All right. Well, keep me in the loop. How that goes, I'm sorry to hear that you had problems. You didn't have that guy in for all that long. Is the new one PTZ as well?
Yeah. I wouldn't buy one that isn't, just because it locks me down a little too much. You spend more for the PTZ, of course, right? Because of the extra. But at the end of the day, the extra flexibility, especially because most of the time I'm putting these up for my wife, I don't care that much. She sits and plays her game. I got her a second screen so that she can watch her chickens on one screen while she's playing her video games on the other. And I'm not actually kidding about that. I was just going to say, and the other thing that she really likes about it is they have two-way audio. So she talks to her chickens.
Those poor chickens are probably traumatized. That thing on the wall stares at us all day, and then every once in a while it says something. The voice comes out of the box.
The Axis camera didn't have that, so I suppose that's something. But it's kind of funny. She walks around with it on her phone sometimes. I hear the chickens like, are you watching the chickens again?
So, I jumped the gun a little bit, but are you ready to get into feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
Our first email comes in from Wiggy. Wiggy writes in and says, hi, Noah and Steve. First of all, thank you both for keeping me inspired and keep me experimenting with Linux. In your latest episode, somebody asked about designing their own distro. I'd recommend Arco Linux. You can learn more at arcolinux.com. This distro is designed specifically to teach you how to build your own ISO. For this chaotic ADHDer, which is... he's referring to himself. For a second, I thought he was taking a stab at the other guy. For this chronic ADHDer, it's proven to be the perfect tool to keep learning easily and return to the computer to get a working state of anything that breaks. By teaching the same mentality as you preach, to build your image in such a way that it can be easily nuked and reinstalled. On that subject, do you have any advice on automating the installation for Wi-Fi credentials to log into all of the different apps? Greetings from Rotterdam. God bless, Wiggy. So, Steve, let's work the email backwards. So, do you have any way to automate logging into all of the various apps?
Sadly, it really is application dependent. Some apps you can actually just kind of copy over the .dot files and the configurations will be there. But some apps you can interact with them via JSON. Some apps actually want you to use the UI. It really depends application by application. There isn't a good method for that. I mean, the really hacky way is to set up something like Selenium, which is going to be way overkill. But it's essentially like, are you familiar with Selenium?
No, tell me more.
It's a testing framework for testing web UIs and stuff like that. It essentially moves the mouse and does clicks and does input for you as if you were there at the keyboard itself. And so lots of companies will use this in order to do automated smoke testing of UI deployments and stuff like that. So super overkill for this, but I mean, if you were really motivated, it's a way to script it. Do you have anything?
Well, the only so it depends on what like you say, it's highly dependent on, I would say, not necessarily applications, but I'll say environment. And I say environment because if you're using the KDE desktop, you can do things like export your KWallet. And that, so on KDE, KWallet is what stores all of the credentials for Wi-Fi, for like if you sign into Element, those sorts of things, your messengers. A lot of those are stored in KWallet. So one of the things that you can do, you can export the KWallet out, and you can export either encrypted, and you have to provide the master password to the wallet, or you can dump it just to an XML file. Now, take the proper considerations if you dump your entire system's, you know, security storage into a plain XML file. But if I were looking at automating a system, I think that's the route I would explore.
So I'm not sure that the wallet would necessarily do that, because the application still has to know to look at the wallet, right? And that's why I would say, because GNOME has a wallet too, absolutely does. And this is not a KDE versus GNOME thing. It's just an observation, right? I'm not sure. Maybe you're right, but I think that just having the wallet restored isn't necessarily going to configure the application to look in the wallet.
Yeah, I think if, so I guess to your point, if Network Manager doesn't know about the SSID, how would it know to call KWallet to ask for the password for the associated SSID? I've not tried it, but the other side of it is they have a documented process for importing and exporting it. It tells me that why else would you export and import if you can't? If it won't reassociate.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Unless maybe just to get your data out of it. I guess that's possible too. I don't know. But the short answer is there isn't really a great way to automate authenticating into stuff, precisely for the fact that you don't really want, if you can automate logging into things, it means you're not required to be there for that process, which is not what you want when it comes to authentication, right? Like, to a degree, you want, most people are going kind of the other direction. Not only do we not want to automate logging in, we want it to be somewhat difficult. We want it to be something you have and something you know to be able to get into the thing. And then kind of from there, we make it easier, like a password manager, something like that. So I might suggest maybe reconsidering your approach. But if you wanted to automate logging in, I would dig further into the wallet subsystem and see if there's a way to do that. So, and then if I tried exporting the wallet and that didn't work, at least on KDE, the second thing I would do is I'd just start exporting portions of my KDE config, because all of those are going to be stored. And undoubtedly, somewhere in there is going to be things like the SSIDs. And if I'm confident if you had the SSIDs and you had KWallet, then you'd be able to automate putting all that back in there. If you have applications that aren't storing it in KWallet, then obviously those aren't going to work. But for the most part, at least my applications, Gajim, Element, the stuff that has authentication, Linphone, those all store them inside of KWallet, and it allows you to pull them out fairly easy. Home Assistant. Steve, you had some troubleshooting this week, not just with cameras, but also with some of your ESP32s.
Yeah, so if you recall, some time ago, I had kind of picked Noah's brain on the fact that Noah came in and helped me kind of do the layout of the initial Wi-Fi in my house some 3 or 4 years ago. And we established where we're going to put the access points and all the rest of that. And so I had started picking Noah's brain some time ago about how every month to month and a half, I have to physically reboot one of the access points. And I don't know why. What would happen is clients would connect to it, but then it's almost like the route was dead on the access point. And so they couldn't get to the internet and nothing could get to them, even though the Unify controller would show them connected to the access point. And so the solution used to be just, you know, every month and a half, go out, unplug the access point, plug it back in, and everything would be fine. Well, this week, about 4 days ago, something like that, devices started to drop off and then reconnect with some frequency, like every 15 to 60 minutes, depending on what the individual device was configured to try to do the retries for. And this was really inconvenient because some of them are things like the stair LED lights. So in the middle of the night, half of the lights would come on and the other half wouldn't.
Oh,
and so
that,
the stairs are half dark.
Oh, and, I'd be looking for somebody to strangle.
Well, yes, that would be me. So really working through troubleshooting, like, what is the problem? I know it's not a Home Assistant problem because Home Assistant is just simply reporting whether they're connected or not. And when Home Assistant says that it can't contact something, trying to go to the local UI, whether it's Tasmota or ESP Home, or in some cases, like commercial off-the-shelf devices like the Emporia View, which is a current transformer, or sorry, a CT clamp for power monitoring, right? Bought that right from the store. They're just, they would connect and disconnect and connect and disconnect. So ended up doing a ton of troubleshooting, from doing everything from, you know, attempting to disable the access point itself, to changing the amount, the power that was transmitted. So if you go search this kind of thing online, there's lots of people talking about how their IoT devices are not connecting to the network, or they're dropping off. And the standard advice out there is things like disable the ICMP and the packet snooping and stuff like that, as well as turning down the power that is emitted on the 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, because apparently that's having an overpowered signal for some of these IoT devices is pretty terrible. So doing all that and not really getting anywhere, eventually ended up trying to disable the IoT SSID on various access points just to see what would happen, and eventually hit on that the access point in the basement for that SSID was the problem. So I disabled that access point's SSID, or specifically the IoT one, and the devices have been stable. And I actually have seen devices that I thought were dead, that had been dropped off the network for quite a while, come back and have reestablished a solid connection. So thought I'd toss that out there for anybody else who might be struggling with this.
So what things, when you think of ESP32, if you're helping your buddy out, who, if I bring something into my house and it falls out, it's going to take away my home automation cred, and then eventually she's going to take my toy away. If you're advising your buddy, where would you say you stand on ESP32? Is this one of those things where you're like, hey, you just got to know a couple of things and then you fix them or work around those things? Or do some of these things happen and you're like, oh man, I feel like maybe I'm changing my mind?
You know what? I don't really hold it against the ESP32s, because one of the things that I really like about them over, say, a Zigbee device, is that I can take the ESP32 and generally I can just plug it into a computer and get the local logs. So I can see, hey, I'm trying to connect. Hey, I have connected and this is my signal strength. Like, you can see all that sort of stuff. If your Zigbee devices, for example, are dropping on and off, the only thing you have to rely on is the controller logs. And that doesn't give you necessarily the full picture. It just shows you something connected, something disconnected, but it doesn't necessarily tell you why. So,
okay.
I'm still in the ESP camp. I'm not sad about that. And it turned out, like I said, to not be their fault. It is definitely the single access point. I don't know why though. Because I only disabled the SSID on the single access point, and they're fine. They're still connecting to the other two access points. You know, they're kind of spreading the load. And I also, before people type in, I did check to see the load was spread across fairly evenly across the access point. So it's not like one had 500 clients and that was, you know, it was overloaded. It's a Wi-Fi 6 access point on top of that. So it was further confusing from the standpoint of, it's got the newer antennas in it. It's relatively new in terms of, I think I bought it 3 or 4 months ago. The range is good. It should have all the fancy new features, and yet it was having problems that I still don't know why.
So one of the other things that came up this week, we have a small little group of, it's actually the former tech director of my church. It's a guy that works at AltaSpeed. Steve is in there. Listener Jeff from the JB community is in there. And we're all kind of, Chris is in there, I think. We're all open source nerds and we're all into Home Assistant. And so we've kind of started sharing various different projects and different things we're doing. And so T. Kwame this week shared a device called the Temptist Weather Station. And it's essentially a way to get a data point into Home Assistant. But Steve, you were saying there's a way to actually get the information from other weather stations that are already out there and running.
Yeah, that came out of the group. So that was not me that made that discovery. Somebody else discovered that there is a way to find similar weather stations in your area. And you can, if they are publishing their data, you can just kind of use theirs. So somebody else in our group was saying, oh, hey, I found one that was like right up the block from me. And so it's as accurate as if I went out and put one out myself. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. I haven't dug more into that because I'm not sure how likely it is to find other people in my area. But, you know, maybe some Saturday when I have a little extra time, I'll go poking for somebody else's weather information.
We'll have the links for this stuff in the show notes, podcast.asknoahshow.com. There you can find a link and check it out for yourself. Steve, I need to peg the collective group's wisdom on fixing my dad's house. He's in a mess. So he purchased a house in which they didn't run the electrical wires to the light switches like you would ordinarily run in a house. So typically the way it works is it comes into your breaker panel. It goes from your breaker panel over to your light switch and then from the light switch up to the light. The idea being it follows the current of electricity. Electricity comes into your house through your breaker panel, flows over to the switch. The switch chooses whether or not that electricity continues to flow onto the light, and thereby you can turn the light on or off with the switch. The way they chose to do it in this particular house was run all of the electrical wire from the panel about 6 feet over in the same electrical room into these ginormous Lutron panels. And then these Lutron panels do all of the switching. Those Lutron panels are then remotely controlled by RF controllers all throughout the house, which are hardlined. So instead of running the power wire to the switch and then to the light at the switch, it's just 120 volt. They're basically outlets, and plugged into the basically outlets are wall mounted light switches, which then RF back to this control surface, this control panel then switches all the lights on and off. This is problematic because if the battery dies in this massive controller, which has happened twice now, it loses all of its programming. And it turns out it requires some esoteric old piece of software. And so this company from Fargo has to drive up. My dad has to pay them a bajillion dollars all the time to put the config back on the system. And he's hacked together the most brilliant and yet idiotic system I've ever seen, insofar as he has a UPS that he uses, and he bought a second controller that is flashed with his config file so that he can swap between the controllers in case one dies or in case the thing, and he can do it without ever cutting the power. And it's just this massive rigmarole that I must free my father from the chains of bondage. And so my thought, Steve, is I was thinking of using the Shelly Pro 4PM. Now, I ran this by him. I said, hey, can we try this with one circuit? And if it works for you, would you be willing to go further? And he's like, yeah, I that would be great. I like it because it is a way to kind of test the purely open source home automation stuff outside of where a certain someone will take my home automation privileges away. Like, that won't happen in my dad's house. He'll just go, that light doesn't work, and then we'll move on. We'll figure a different way. So what I'm thinking, Steve, and I want your thoughts, the Shelly Pro 4, and we take four of those circuits and we switch them over into the Shelly from the big panel. Then we control them either using the Zigbee Network Scene Controller, which is basically a four quad channel Zigbee controller, or the Z-Wave Scene Controller. Now, you have one of these, and it's effectively a little bit nicer because it's got five buttons, one big one and four small ones. But the thing I really like about the one that you sent me is it fits into a traditional light socket so it can be hardwired. And then you also sent me some other bonus ones. I'll ask you to get into those for a moment. But what do you think of my overall plan?
I think it's interesting, especially given the way that the house is set up, right?
The idiotic way they built that esoteric house, the special snowflake.
Interesting. It's interesting. I think that it has more potential to function properly with the Shelly device right on the line, kind of interrupting the flow. And I have had nothing but fantastic experiences with Shelly. So I have had one or two of them fail, but contacting Shelly, like, they replaced them and they gave me the next model up.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah. I've had two times where, so two out of 30 something devices, I want to say. So I have quite a few Shellys kicking around now between out in my chicken coop and my fireplace and Actually, interestingly enough, I use them in the higher voltage places. So like the fireplace and where downstairs we plug in. So it's on the on my projector. So I guess I've decided to really trust them with higher draw devices. And yeah, I think they do a wonderful job. I have some that are out in the elements that are somehow surviving the South Dakota elements, where it's beyond their toleration. Like they officially tolerate down to negative 20 Celsius, and I'm 100% sure we hit at least negative 40 this year. So they have gone above and beyond and just continue to keep going. So I'd be, especially your Pro line, I would be surprised if you had a bad experience with them.
All right. Well, I'm probably going to kidnap you and bring you up here, and we're going to bang it out and see what happens. Carl Ritchell, he is the president and founder of System 76, PCs Born to Run Linux. Carl, welcome into the program.
Thanks for having me.
You have launched on a new effort with Cosmic. Tell me about the origin of Cosmic. How did that project start? Why did you get into that space?
Right, well, we felt like there was a need and a desire for a new desktop environment that was kind of born in a more recent age, perhaps, and with newer technologies. We started with experimenting with GNOME and a new user experience that we called Cosmic then at that point as well. But what we brought to, what we did was adapt GNOME Shell to our UX, which added a launcher that was unique, an application library, a dock, and auto tiling. And you know, from that we learned a lot from our users, and the response was overwhelmingly positive, and we wanted to continue that that design and UX from there on. But with GNOME, that meant what we'd be doing is adapting GNOME Shell every 6 months. And if you're spending your time like taking something not made for what you want to do and then adapting it every 6 months, you're not spending that 6 months on more progress for your customers and your users. So we made the decision at that point that the best thing for us to do, we just finished an LTS. We had, I think we felt like we had a 2-year span where we could build something really big in those 2 years and come out with 2404 with a new DE. So we went cracking at that point and started building Cosmic, which has its own custom toolkit. All the widgets are custom. It's written from Rust from the ground up, so obviously a massive project. But we're getting close, so I think we're actually going to make our 2-ish year goal and have a release of Cosmic for 2404.
Talk to me a little bit about the desire for tiling features. What was the feedback that you were hearing from your customers, and who is best suited for a tiling window manager?
Right. Well, one thing I think about tiling window managers, I consider them very sticky features. Sticky in that once you start using them and get used to them, it's very hard to go back to using floating windows because they're just more efficient. All your information is laid out in front of you. It's like a personal assistant for your operating system. It just lays out all of your windows for you. But the thing is, they're kind of hard to get into because it's the tiling window managers that existed before were all or nothing, like i3 or Sway. They're fantastic and I think really innovative. But you were jumping into tiling and you needed to have the motivation to like spend time learning how to do them and how to use them. Well, with POP 2204 and the tiling that we did there, you defaulted to floating windows and you enabled tiling windows. And so it made it an easier entry point for people to like experience what this was like. We've taken what we built there and refined it considerably. So it's easier to learn the shortcuts. The floating and the tiling modes are much closer to each other. Like the shortcuts between them are the same. The features are the same. You can stack windows in our floating mode, and you can stack them like you can in tiles. So stacked windows are like having it's application tabs. So you can imagine Firefox with a bunch of your websites in different tabs. This is applications in different tabs. So if you're on a small screen, that can be really helpful too. Whether you like floating or tiling. We also survey our customers regularly, and we found that about 38%, 38 to 40% use tiling all the time or most of the time. So that's a very high percentage. So that means the response and the value of the feature that we built was high. The response was positive. But that also meant that 60%, 62% are still using floating windows. So floating windows and those users are just as important to us in Cosmic as tiling windows. Those folks like tiling windows. But we also want to help people that didn't jump on board then see the value in tiling window management.
When you got into building computers and you launched a computer company specifically designed to run Linux, did you ever think you were going to get into the software development side?
No, I thought that we would spend most of our time on hardware enablement and hardware development and design. As things evolved, we wanted to leave the operating system to Canonical and others. But as the Linux landscape evolved, it wasn't as vibrant. But when Canonical kind of left Unity development behind and went to GNOME, the whole ecosystem wasn't as vibrant. But that seemed to that moment in the Linux time kind of feels to me like it shook things up. All of a sudden, there was more interest in different desktop environments. There was interest in different styles of computing. There was interest, and maybe these just things started, came to fruition around that time, and they were there before. But it feels like today, the Linux desktop environment world is so much more vibrant than it was at that point. But it was an inflection point for us because the desktop it made sense to me what Canonical's decision was. But to us, the desktop is still everything. And Linux was what we care about, what we love, and what we work on every day. So we wanted to continue that investment. And then PopOS was born from that. When you start building an operating system, you start thinking about everything that a user experiences when they see that, and you want to scratch every itch they have and improve the product continuously. And so it just snowballs into more and more desire to build a great product for your customer and more investments and more time. But in the end, something that we get to give away to the world that I hope is going to be wildly useful to people.
So there's this, what I would consider a false premise that tiling window manager is really for people that only live in the terminal, right? If you're using CLI-based applications, that's where a tiling window manager is helpful. You've taken a different approach insofar as you're trying to make tiling accessible to people that maybe wouldn't ordinarily use tiling. Can you talk about some of the features of Cosmic that allow you to rapidly move in and out of tiling, the UI options that allow you to set your preferences and customize the look and feel of the desktop?
Right. That's great. Great question, because we put a lot of emphasis on and precisely that. We have on the top panel, we have what's called applets. They're small applications that have different functionality, like a volume applet, a battery applet, notifications, and each one of those has functionality. Like, we believe in, we like our user not to need to go into settings to do a lot of things that they would do pretty quickly right from their desktop, like connect to headphones and so forth. The tiling applet is up there as well. And once you start Cosmic, it's going to be in floating mode, and your windows will open in floating mode. You click the tiling applet, enable tiled windows, and they will magically just go tile into place. You can tile. We also found that because some people tile depending on their workload or what they're doing or workflow. So for some, it doesn't make sense tiling when they're gaming or something like that. But when they have their web browser and a document or a code editor or something like that that they're working on side by side, it makes more sense because you might have a browser and a code editor and a terminal and those things tiled. So what we enabled with Cosmic is tiling per workspace, meaning that on workspace one, maybe you have everything tiled. On workspace two, maybe you're playing a video and it's floating, or you have Slack or Mattermost or something like that, or Discord. So you can pick and choose which workspace is, and it's workspaces per monitor, which is pretty big because today workspaces span monitors, which means you can't move workspaces on one monitor and have the other one stay in place and so forth. So workspaces per monitor plus tiling per workspace means that you can really set up your environment exactly how you want it to work.
That's absolutely fantastic. For those that are coming from i3 or Sway, how are they going to feel about keyboard shortcuts?
We put a lot of effort into refining the keyboard shortcuts. So we think of Super as the operating system's key. That's the one where anything you initiate with Super is, the operating system owns that. And you can add modifiers to it, like Control or Shift and so forth. So Super and arrow keys will move focus amongst the windows that are tiled. Also, in floating, it moves floating the focus for floating windows. So that's one of the combinations that we've done where when you move from floating to tiling or tiling to floating, you can use the same shortcuts and it feels natural. Super Shift and arrows moves a window around. Super X and choosing another window will swap the window. Super S stacks them. So they all have a pretty good, like, you can kind of see S with stacking, X with switching, swapping. They're easy to learn. We don't have an adjustment mode. We used to have enter adjustment mode, the super enter, and then you use arrow keys or other things to move windows. You don't have to do that anymore, and we found that was a really positive improvement as well.
If people want to get started and play with this, it hasn't been officially released yet, but I understand there's ways to get early access to the Playground.
There is. So you can go to our GitHub. It's PopOS. It's github.com/pop-os. Look for Pop Epoch. It's E-P-O-C-K-C-H. And there was instructions for trying out Cosmic.
Carl Ritchell, president and founder of System 76. We appreciate the time. We'll get you back soon.
Thanks for having me.
The thing I think that is brilliant about the approach that System 76 is taking is that tiling window managers, I've heard this a few different times. Oh, it's for people that use CLI applications. It's not. It's really not. It's really for a lot more. It's for people that want the most efficient way to draw applications across a set screen real estate and then interact with those applications. The Linux kernel handles talking to the hardware. The next step up is I want to arrange applications in a specific way, and then I want to interact with them. And if you want to do that and have the least amount of things in between you and that, either by way of, troubleshooting or lack thereof, from the standpoint that there's just less complexity, all of those things lead me to really like tiling windows, to a tiling window managers. And I've kind of gotten sucked into the i3 hole and I haven't been able to dig my way back out. What's appealing to me about Cosmic is it blends the two together. So when you want floating windows and a normal quote unquote desktop, you can have that. And so for somebody like my wife, who I have tried to talk her into, and I'm like, I think you'd really like this, but she likes being able to go between, this might really, really work. And the other thing that I really like about the System 76 model is instead of building what they think is a perfect desktop and then, everybody picks their own, they're approaching it the other way around. They're taking people who are buying computers and asking them, what do you want to see in a desktop? And then building that desktop. Steve, any chance you would ever check out Cosmic, even if you rent it on Arch, but check it out as a desktop environment?
Yeah, I mean, I've got nothing. I use a bunch of the tiling window features in GNOME already. Not to the degree that I would require a full tiling desktop. But yeah, I would consider checking it out for sure.
Boot.dev. It's the most captivating, finger-flying, addictive way to learn code. And I learned about this at Linux Fest Northwest. One of my favorite things to do is there are people that I only see at very specific conferences. And this time it was Adram. And Adram, I actually met inside of a hotel and we closed the hotel down. We were inside of the hotel, the little hotel lobby area. And I was on the airplane on my way into Linux Fest Northwest a few years ago. And I was in the IRC room chatting with a bunch of people. Unbeknownst to me, he was sitting in the hotel lobby. And so I get in and I check in and I take my bags up to my room and I'm plopped down in bed and go back to talking to him. And what hotel are you staying at? Oh, I'm at Spring Hills. Oh, I'm downstairs right now. I'm like, really? And so I came downstairs and we were down there till like 3, 4, 5 in the morning. It was ridiculous. And so hadn't seen him for a few years and he was there at Linux Fest Northwest. And so I was able to hang out with him quite a bit. And he was telling me the last I had caught up with him, he was working at Amazon as a data center tech and as doing system administration type things, which is very closely mimics my career. And I learned that he had since made a transition into the networking side, which again, also fits my wheelhouse at Altaspeed. And now he's getting into backend. And first, when he said he was getting into backend development, I'm like, oh, time out, that's where I'm out. Like, that's not me. You don't want me as a coder because I'm obstinate and I don't like doing things other people's ways. And it's not for me. And he's like, well, you might want to check out boot.dev. And I said, what's boot.dev? And he said, it's the gamification of coding. So it allows you to learn things like Python in a game way. And instead of working towards getting through this tutorial or that tutorial, you're playing a great game and trying to achieve an objective. That objective gets you experience points. Those experience points give you those dopamine hits as you're progressing along. And I went to check them out. And what's interesting is they're very explicit and honest. It's not a $10,000 bootcamp to learn programming. It's not a $50,000 university degree. They're a self-paced, gamified online platform that allows for back-end web development. And they have priced it such that you could buy it like a gym membership. So I think it's like $45-$50 a month. When asked how long does it take to go through their program, they say that the average is 12 months, but you can clip through it as much as you want. So if there's something you already know, you can skip through it. Steve, I know you are pretty handy with Python. What do you think about the gamification of coding? Do you think it's an efficient way to learn something?
I mean, it becomes a personal choice. I mean, I feel like all I do is spend all day every day telling people that it depends, including my clients. But it really does depend in this case. Largely, what I've found is that the gamification of a thing ends up not actually encouraging a wide-ranging understanding. You might get individual snippets and, you know, maybe I know how to draw a box on the screen, but the ability to move beyond that and draw parallels to something you actually want to do is difficult for most people at best, including myself, depending on the area that I'm working on. And so because of that, the gamification encourages you to play the game as opposed to the deeper thought of what you're actually trying to achieve in a language. So it becomes a thing where a highly motivated individual is likely to do well with this. Whereas if you're trying to, like, you're just starting out and you're like, I want to learn thing, but I don't know where to start. It might help you get a start, but it's also not going to keep you motivated in the long run to go out and write, you know, a web front end if you're going to do that in Python. Because oftentimes, as the content creator, you have to make choices of what you're going to present to the user and when you're going to present that. And that might not line up with something the person trying to learn finds useful.
So you can check it out. If you're the kind of person that you know what you want to get out of Python or you know what you're trying to do, maybe this is a way to kind of take the edge off and make it a little bit more fun. If you don't know exactly what you want to achieve and you just want to learn, like, or you're just kind of exploring, maybe this isn't the right tool for you. But the thing that Adrian used it for was to teach himself Python so that he could use a tool called Scraply. Scraply, which you can learn more at on their GitHub page, which we'll have linked in the show notes, podcast.asknoahshow.com. It's a Python library focused on connecting to devices, specifically network devices, things like routers, switches, firewalls, etc., via SSH and Telnet, and allows for the pushing of configuration. And so the idea is that it's a fast and flexible way to reach out to network devices and deploy configs. And so he was telling me at his new job, he's routinely tasked with, hey, add this VLAN to, you know, 60 switches, or hey, that switch died, go put a new one in and push its config down. He's using Scraply to automate the entire process. Now, they have pre-built what they call drivers, basically the instruction set to talk to various model switches. So if they already have one built for the switch that you're using, then it's really easy to configure and just send the configuration change out. If, however, they don't have drivers because they're too old or too esoteric, you can write them yourself. But of course, in order to do that, you need to know Python. And so it was a means to an end for him. He used boot.dev to teach himself Python so that he could use Scraply, so that he could automate part of his job, so that he could spend less time, you know, hand typing out configs and more time doing the funner aspects like automating. But the thing that I think that really appeals to me probably more than anything else is I've said many times on the air and other places, I'm just not much of a gamer. I don't take a lot of joy out of sitting around and gaming. However, if I can tie that gaming to something productive, it's kind of in the same way I don't sit and like watching TV, but I'll sit and binge watch documentaries all day long, in part because I feel like I'm growing from the experience. I feel like I'm coming away with something I didn't have before. The thing that appeals to me about things like boot.dev, sure, if you're looking to get a $100,000 career with software development and you don't know where to start, or you need somebody to kind of coax you along, boot.dev might be the right choice. For me, it seems like a nice way to have an enjoyable game. And yeah, maybe I will focus on the game more than I'm focused on actually learning programming, but I will over time, almost like osmosis, it will come through my head. What do you think of that idea?
I mean, there's some challenges there because I find now, the disclaimer here is I have a lot of experience with other learning systems and not boot.dev. So I have not personally tried that. So I'm not disparaging their system at all.
Speaking in general.
In general, I find that gamification ends up not really teaching you much because you end up not finding much to grab onto. Like the whole purpose of gamification is to make a game out of things, to keep it engaging. And the difficulty is tying that together in a way where you're continuing to learn. When you are doing the gamification, you feel like you're making progress because that is the whole purpose of it. Are you actually making that progress? That's debatable. And that's where I have concerns about the about a system that really focuses on gamification. It's been my experience that they are less effective in the long run. They're really good at getting you interested and keeping you motivated, and I like them for that. But in terms of the actual learning, I really think that your money is better spent, you know, buying an hour of somebody's time at some point and asking them questions and then going away and helping them, have them help focus you as opposed to the generalization of the gamification. It's more work that way. It requires you to go and find a teacher that will help you and then also a teacher that is going to mesh well with you. But every time that I have tried this in the past, I spend more time, more unproductive time trying to extrapolate what I need from the game, the gamification, than I do actually learning the thing.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do want to briefly touch on it. So NixOS is all over the news this week, in part because there's some recent events in the Nix community that have resulted in what they would describe as unpleasant situations over the past last week. And so Jonathan Ringer will no longer be fulfilling the role of release manager due to multiple, as they're calling them, code of conduct violations. And as a result, Nix package maintainers are leaving the project. Many of those events have been percolating for a while, but now they've reached a boiling point. And I want to be very careful with how I tread on these eggshells, but what I think is important for us all to just kind of take a deep breath in and step back and remember is that on the other side of that keyboard and mouse and monitor is another living, breathing human being. And that human being has feelings, and that human being has a perception of self-worth, and that human being has a desire to be involved in the FOSS community. And so I think we need to be very, very careful with how we treat other people so that we don't step on toes. Because what a lot of what I'm reading is really disappointing and makes me sad. And so we say that we want to be inclusive and accepting to people. I'd need someone to help me understand how this is exemplifying that, because I'm what I feel like I'm seeing is the exact opposite. My perception is that I'm seeing a lot of the opposite. We want and need organizations to fund open source. That's a good thing. A lot of really great things have come from not just private organizations. That's certainly there with the Red Hats and Canonicals of the world, but some of the most amazing things has come from public tax dollars, right? Tor, SE Linux, those sorts of things don't wind up on our desktops and our laptops if those projects are not willing to take public dollars to fund them. So I would take it one step further and say tax dollars should, if they're doing anything with tax dollars and it involves software, it should be open source software so that the taxpayer can have the code that they paid for to develop the thing. And then my last thing I would leave you with is focus on meritocracy. the great, awesome, cool, fantastic, best thing about the internet, bar none, is we get to invent ourselves and we get to be who we want to be. We're not who the government tells us we are. We're not who we were born as. We get to invent our identity. We get to invent our online persona, and we get to present that online persona. And you know what? When that online persona stubs its toe, we can do away with it and bring up another online persona. And that's the beauty in the anonymity of the internet. And so if we stop focusing on all of the things that kind of break us apart and divide us, and I'm telling you, I'm calling it right now, Red Book prediction. If this continues, it's not just going to be NixOS. This is going to cause communities to implode. So rather than focusing on all of the things that we disagree with and all of the things that are our various different sides and points of view and talking points, let's focus on the meritocracy of getting the thing done. What code works best, that be the winner. Steve, am I kind of out in La La Land, or am I onto something?
It's always really a difficult situation, especially for me, who I tend to be a person that's relatively apathetic to, let's say, personal eccentricities.
No, I don't. You? Really?
Right?
I'm shocked.
Unless it is directly punching me in the face and impacting our day-to-day interaction, you could like Russian Ofra. I don't really care. It's not really relevant to how I find you as a person and how well I think you behave in the community. And so because of that, I have a really hard time when these sorts of issues come up, because I fundamentally don't understand. And sometimes that brings out anger, because a lot of times, like other people, when there is a situation that's confusing and not easily understood, anger kind of follows. And I'm not exactly sure how to process the whole situation from a community standpoint. Like, I think it's sad anytime that we've decided to single anybody out and essentially cripple them for a single aspect of their life. Like, now very clearly not talking about like being anti-Semitic or literally calling for hate to be done to somebody, but when I'm talking about just an attribute about a person, regardless of what it is, shouldn't be the sum total of who that person is and the deciding factor as to how we interact with the person. I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So if you want to dig into it, we'll have the links in the show notes. They're available at podcast.asknoahshow.com. You can read for yourself, get kind of caught up on what's going on. I hope NixOS works out. I was starting to get excited about what they were doing and some of the products that were coming up alongside of it. I was nowhere near installing it on, you know, my bare metal and switching over to as my daily driver or anything, but I there's a real potential there. And again, what is most concerning to me is I'd like to see this kind of thing not be a thing, however it is we get there. The music in our ears means we're out of time. I thank you for joining us. You can check out all of the articles and references at podcast.asknoahshow. There you'll find not just all of the articles and references for this week, but the entire back catalog. We'll see you next Tuesday.